Chapter 3. Metamorphic. In Kafka's The Metamorphosis, poor Gregor Samsa went to bed as a man and woke up as a roach. It helps to remember that dramatic change when pondering the lineage of metamorphic rocks. After all, they too used to be something else. But their transformation took millions of years of heat and pressure, not a mere single night. In taste terms, in metamorphic-derived soils, you can get broad flavors, the rich and the powerful. But the rock and vine in the sun and the heat and the resulting wines can be explosive. In the wet and the cool, they can prove a little shyer, but still plump in the mouth. Those rocks create thicker skins, which sometimes can be a problem for red grapes. Heat or cool, wet or dry, what they have in common are these textures that spread across the mouth in a filling way. Metamorphics are grouped into two categories, non-foliated and foliated. The Latin origin of the word foliate is folium, meaning leaf. In geological terms, it refers to the way the minerals are aligned in the rock. Each layer of rock might be as thin as a sheet of paper, akin to the mufeia, literally thousand-leaf pastry of France, or the phyllo pastry of Greece. So a non-foliated rock is one piece, with no layering. Non-foliated metamorphic rocks have a pretty uniform appearance. Hornfels, marble, quartzite, and amphibolite are non-foliated. Hornfels, a bastard child, can come from just about anything, but it's most often thought of as originating from siliceous shale mud. Amphibolite is mostly metamorphosed from the igneous and generally has a high percentage of iron and magnesium. Marble and lapis are easy to trace. They both descended from limestone. The many layers of foliated rocks can be found in slate, phyllite, schist, and gneiss. Gneiss, which can morph from volcanic, granite, or schist, often has strikingly visible stripes coursing through the stone. Slate and schist are profoundly important rocks when it comes to grape soil. They come from a younger type of sedimentary rock, shale. Though these siblings might lie close to each other on the geological family tree, they are as different as Cain and Abel. Slate and schist. Dark and brittle, slate has an almost neutral pH. Fragile, formed under lesser pressure and heat than schist, it is less compressed. Slate dazzles with different textures and colors, including brown, red, black, and blue. In the Priorat region, in eastern Spain, 2 hours or so from Barcelona, they call their particular brand of slate, which looks like large copper shards weathered in the hot sun, Licorella. In Germany's Mosel, especially, the pieces are longer and broader and come in a multitude of colors. There, they call them schiefer, but don't differentiate between slate and schist. In the Mosel, the soil is just one metamorphic blur. Schist often has a higher pH than slate and a greater density. Like slate, it comes in all sorts of shades, including black, blue, and silver. Unlike slate, it can present itself in bold, hard forms, such as over on the northern Atlantic region of Spain's Ribera Sacra, where it's called loses. The Roussillon, in the south of France, has two kinds of schist, the type that looks like broken stone mats called dalle, and more slender fragments called frite. But what does schist and slate mean for the vine and wine? The best schist and slate soils are layered at right angles to the earth's surface rather than horizontally. This affects the way the water can seep in directly, which is essential as, depending on how much clay there is in the decomposed stone, the soil can have very poor retention. Also, those kinds of soils erode more quickly, especially if there are winter freezes, as in the Mosel in Germany. This makes it easier for the roots to dig deep into the ground for a good drink of water. Terroir expert Pedro Parra believes that no matter what the climatic conditions, the wines from grapes grown in schist are big wines. They can also show a streak of iron alongside powerful tannins. But how does schist and slate affect each of our favorite regions, such as the Loire, the south of France, and Iberia? The Loire and Anjou Noir. The story of the town of Angers is a tale of two soils. The Tuffeau limestone Anjou Blanc, and the dark schist and slate of Anjou Noir. While they both produce exciting wines, they can be markedly different. The grape that experiences the greatest discrepancy on these two soils is Chenon. Some have described Chenon on schist and slate as fleshier and more savory than its limestone-grown counterparts. There are some who get nasty, though, saying that the Chenon on the dark rocks is austere, powerful, bitter, and intellectual. One of these would be French wine critic Michel Bétain. He is on record likening Chenon on schist to stale choucroute, old cheese rind, rancid butter, moldy dough. While Bétain is vociferous in his dislike of Chenon on schist, the critic Andrew Jefford made a passionate case for it in his marvelous book, The New France. He's not alone. Anjou raised Pascaline and I love it. Far from Bétain's description, we find that the best Chenon Blancs from schist have a deep violet and quince complexity with a round, plump, grainy, juicy fullness. Like them or love them. And it's best you do a tasting and find out where you fall. There are concrete reasons why they taste so very different. Sponge-like Tuffeau performs better in dry years. It has what it takes to hold on to whatever rain does fall. Meanwhile, in the cool, wet years, it is the schist that does best, with its great capacity to hold on to warmth, yet let go of the rain, providing better drainage. Looking for more answers, I went to talk to the winemakers themselves. I often tasted with Kenji and Mai Hodgson. These expats from Vancouver settled in the thriving village of Fay d'Anjou to make wine. They are young and newish, but their wine's vitality has always impressed me. Fay d'Anjou was once known exclusively for its sweet wines and now has a clutch of superfine winemakers who are ultra-natural in their approach. The Somme whites don't usually go through the malo, Kenji explained, mentioning the malolactic fermentation that usually follows alcoholic fermentation and softens the acids, adding a fleshy roundness. This is possibly because the colder cellar temperatures of the troglodyte caves inhibit it. Another reason that malo is naturally inhibited is that limestone soils are lower in pH than schist and higher in acid, and that can be inhospitable to malolactic bacteria. Hodgson posited that some of the Samorois might choose to block the malo, often with sulfur dioxide and cold, in order to give the wines the impression of more acid. This is something committed minimalist winemakers in the area would never forcibly do, and there are a lot of natural winemakers in the Anjou. So, he said, we in the Noir are left with a softer acidity, lactic, rather than a tangier one, or mineral, or tension, or whatever you might call it. Hence, the wines can be softer and less angular. But there are factors at play that conspire to make a different kind of wine. There's humidity from the three main rivers, the Loire, the Layton, and the Aubance. The protection from the southwestern rains by the Massif de Mauges south of the Léon, which makes this part of the Anjou one of the warmest, driest spots in all the Loire Valley, boosts the wine's alcohols. The humid wind blows up as if in a funnel from the Atlantic, which helps to dry out the soils, especially if it's a year when there's not that much rain. So, with all these conditions, botrytis, that rot which concentrates the sugars in a grape, has been part of the landscape of Anjou Noir's wines, much more than in Anjou Blanc, which is located more inland and has less humidity and fog influence. It is because of this remarkable affinity for the noble rot that his region is one of the world's holiest grails for sweet wine. Likewise, the fame of the area's sweet wines has long overshadowed the region's dry examples. However, in the current situation, dry Chenon is in a major growth phase and have become one of the area's most exciting developments. What was behind such a display of disgust for Chenon on schist from Bétain? Was it his preference for a more lean and mean wine that got him so disgruntled with the schistic dry Chenon? Or is he just a staunch traditionalist who wants the wines of that area to accept the botrytis and for the Anjou Noir to stay the sweet winemaking region it's always been? It would be easy to attribute a single reason for Bétain's dislike, but in reality, neither life nor wine is so simple. And questioning certain attitudes, no matter who voices them, keeps us all honest. The Dirt. The whole big wedge of schist in the Loire, discussed in the Muscadet chapter, started out as sediments 540 million years ago, before they evolved from shale by the erection of that enormous mountain range, the Hercynian. Each time the mountains pushed forth, they thrust up the crest, heating and compressing rocks on the gigantic foothills. From there, the shale metamorphed into types of schists. The Loire River, the longest in France, is one that meanders and breaks into tributaries and links all of the regions, becoming a dividing line between the white and the black soils. Both regions were linked by south-facing slopes of slate and schist between the Loire, Aubance, and Léon rivers. Mingled into the soil is also schiste graisseux, clayish schist with some silica, sometimes called sandy shale, a mongrel clay made up of plenty of quartz, mica, and feldspar. Additionally, there are bits of igneous rocks, green basaltic spilite, and greenish rhyolite, prevalent in that village famous for Chenon, Savinière. The grapes. The Touraine poet Rabelais mentioned Chenon Blanc, previously known as Plante d'Anjou, in 1534 in the first book of his Gargantua. But, as wonderful as it is, the grape has issues. It buds early and ripens late, which in the northern Loire is a very inconvenient truth. This means it's vulnerable to late frosts, which kill the bud or flower, as well as the rains during harvest time. But what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Pascaline, a great Chenon supporter and defender, explained, "There's no other grape that is so responsive to soil or its farmer. If you don't know what you're doing, you'll make crap wine, but it has a lot of natural characteristics that make it great. Acidity, the tannin from its skins, a rhubarb, savory aspect to the fruit. It can be made in any style, from sparkling to sweet, and it is semi-aromatic. I just don't love really aromatic grapes. Semi-aromatic ones express so much more as they are more transparent to their terroir. This grape gets around. At one time, it was the most widely planted vine in California. Now there's barely a thimbleful of Chenon plantings in the Golden State, having shrunk to a mere 5,000 acres or so. Yet new plantings abound, and those hunting down the remaining old vines are finding a renaissance, mostly on sand or loam. South Africa has more Chenon acreage than the Loire. It was once called Steen, but there, too, it was either used as a blending grape or yanked out and Chardonnay was plunked in. In truth, much of their Chenon was awful, but the only ones to blame were the winemakers. There, as in California, it's making a comeback. Anjou and slate soils aren't home to white alone. There are reds here as well. Do look for Grolot, a much maligned grape that managed to get the reputation of only being good for the garbage. That slander only came out because it had been abused in the vineyard. In the hands of Joël Ménard, Domaine de Sablonnet, and Benoît Coureau, you'd be happy if you had a high-acid velvet wine. But the king of Chenon's queen is Cabernet Franc. On the schist of the Noir, you'll find more concentration and power and perhaps a bit more of what is called rustic. Winemaker Profile. Richard Leroy. The schist-rich Rabelais-sur-Léon and surroundings were once famed for their sweet wines, but now they're getting invaded by natural winemakers who want to make dry ones. We visited one of these new iconoclasts, the schist Chenon master Richard Leroy. Leroy, a soccer player turned investment banker turned vigneron, was influenced by the no-sulfur natural winemaking of Domaine de Sablonnet and Marc Angeli. Today, Richard Leroy makes only dry white wines, and he makes only two cuvées from two distinct vineyards. His wines are celebrated and have found their way into the cellars of collectors and onto fancy wine lists. Yet, in 2010, after experimenting for 5 years, he ditched safety and went sulfur-free. This was to be our first taste. When Leroy opened his door to us, we saw a lunch party in motion. With an assorted crew, including winemaker Benoît Coureau and the then furry Leroy himself, who immediately splashed wine into our glasses. This wine had been pulled from his private cellar. It was a leftover from the days when he had a fancy job and more conventional tastes. Drumroll, please. It was a 1989 Coche de Riz Les Rougeaux. Many of our friends who collect the stuff would be plotting at our good fortune. Today it was worth about $700. What do you think? Richard asked. For us, this famous wine was a disaster, short, acrid, and generally inexpressive. The others nodded in agreement. Lois commented how his tastes had changed over the years, as he evolved from a trophy collector to a seeker of sincere wines. I had to note the dichotomy. Poison to us was another's pleasure. We let the trophy bottle sit in its loneliness. Pascaline and I reached for Richard's 2012. Labeling his two single vineyard wines as Vin de France, Lois left the appellation of Anjou for good in 2008. He has the luxury of name recognition. His customers are buying Richard Loire and not Anjou. Like so many others here, he believes that's worth more to him than a classification that he thinks has no standards of quality. His wines, though both from the black soils, are wonderful in a side-by-side comparison with exactly the same vinification. The fact that both had undergone mallow allowed us to compare the soil's impact, in this case, the more volcanic rhyolite versus the more metamorphic schist. The Clos de Roulière is a small parcel, all 0.7 hectares close to the Léon River. It is gray schist with some gravel texture. Pascaline saw the resulting wine as broader, with more aromatics up front and flavors of root vegetable, flower, and white tea. I saw it as an extrovert, with plenty of savory fruit and high-toned leather on the finish. Rich, with the creaminess of a Meursault and 13.5% ABV, it needs to shed the baby fat to be a stunner. Les Noëls de Montbenot came from a rockier hilltop site, where it's windier, and the 50-year-old vines grow on metamorphosed schist grisot with bands of igneous volcanic rhyolite. We admit to a preference for the wines out of this 2-hectare vineyard. There was some reduction, but after that came violet. It was more refined, less overtly sexy, more angular, with a vibrant finish. Richard Chenons have made it onto some of the most exciting wine lists, whether natural or not, in the world. When we ask him about the nature of terroir, he says, terroir wines are produced by people who understand their soils. Soils are to be navigated, whether there is the roundness from the sandy shale or the power from the volcanic and the schist. In other words, you can abuse terroir and make a stupid wine anywhere. But to make a wine of depth, you have to commune with the soil and listen to its needs, much like any good relationship. Noir and Blanc Chenon Cheat Sheet. Anjou Noir. 1. Appellations for dry wines. Anjou, Savagnières, Savagnières Roche au Moine, Savagnières Coulis de Saron. Appellations for sweet wines. Beaulieu-sur-Léon, Faye d'Anjou, Roblet-sur-Léon, Rochefort-sur-Loire, Saint-Aubin de Louegne, Saint-Lambert de Latay, Chaume, Carte de Chaume, Bonnezeau, Coteau de l'Aubance, Anjou Coteau de Loire. 2. Soils. Green and purple schists, schist grisot, slate, volcanic, rhyolite, spillite, etc. 3. Influences. Atlantic influence with a warmer, drier microclimate, humidity from rivers. 4. Historically warmer, shallow cellars near street level, as the harder stone makes digging deep cellars impossible. 5. Will go through partial to full malolactic fermentation. 6. More affected by botrytis. 7. Profile. Lusher, fuller, higher in alcohol, more dry extract, can be varietal if not farmed properly. Anjou Blanc. 1. Appellations for Anjou Blanc. Saint-Mer. While the towns of Puy-Notre-Dame, Champigny, and Brizy are not recognized as cru for the whites, there are some fantastic wines coming from them. You should definitely seek out the Chenon from this area. 2. Soils. Limestone, including yellow and white tufo, flint in Puy-Notre-Dame. 3. Influences. More continental, drier, and less humid wind. 4. Due to softer soil, easier to dig deep for deeper and colder cellars. 5. Mallow. Often none. 6. Profile. There are some sweet wines, but this place is more famous for dry and semi-sweet wines. The dry wines are more angular, lemony, and structured. Who to drink? Fermé de la Sancière, Marc Angéli, Biodynamic. Richard Leroy, Biodynamic. Benoit Corot, Organic. Kenji and Mai Hodgson, Organic. Didier Chaffardon, Organic. Domaine de Sablonette, Organic. Domaine Patrick Baudin, Organic. Python Paille, Organic. Lévin Herbel, Organic. Lévin de Babas, Organic. Jean-Christophe Garnier, Organic. Agnes and René Mosse, Organic. Toby Bainbridge, Organic. Domaine Les Grands Vignes, Biodynamic. Jean-François Chenet, Organic. Olivier Cousin, Organic. Stéphane Bernadeau, Biodynamic. Domaine de Bablou, Organic. Bruno Rochard, Organic. Lagrange Aubel, Organic. Sébastien Fleuret, Organic. Philippe Delmay and Aureline Martin, Organic. Damien Bureau, Organic. Savonnière. On the north bank of the Loire, on hills of schist facing southwest and opening up onto the river, lies this nearly 363-acre appellation. There are some other grapes planted here, but it's best to think of this area as 100% beautiful Chenon. It's tucked into a tiny hamlet and has been known since Roman times for its extraordinary wine. Legendary is the word that comes to mind. It's been said that it is here where Chenon Blanc rises to the same stature as Burgundy's Montrachet. Well, never mind that it is only in recent memory, as late as the 1960s, that these wines were made in a dry style. But what they are on that schist is intense, powerful, and sometimes quite high in alcohol. No matter what the potential, Savonnière was resting on its heritage, with few people working the soil and letting the land speak. That is, until Nicolas Joly rolled into town and changed everything. I had been told not to worry about the interview. All I needed to do was say hello, sit down, and Nicolas Joly, the leader of one of the most powerful movements in viticulture, biodynamics, would proceed to talk. I introduced myself. In the midst of a chaos of stacked paper, I sat on a plump, chintz-covered couch as he asked to the air, "Where to start?" He didn't wait for an answer because he began chattering about biodynamics, his Return to Terroir tasting series, and the current crisis in the wine world. He may be a little nuts, but any visionary is. Nicolas Joly, born in 1945, is a former banker who escaped New York and London. He ran back to the banks of the Loire, to his family's estate, said to be one of the most profound sites for Chenon Blanc in the world, Coulée de Saron, in the hamlet of Savonnière. The estate's vineyard, its own appellation and a monopole, was planted in 1130 by the Cistercians and appeals to mystics and gourmands alike. The reputation of the wines goes back almost as long and was noted by Louis XI, who referred to them as the Gold Drop. For centuries, they were considered among the finest wines of France. The grape, of course, was one factor. Chenon Blanc does something special on those complex and historic soils, mainly schist, with some patches of volcanic. The vineyard, Coulée de Saron, is the spiritual heart of the domaine and overlooks the Loire River. In addition, Joly, increasingly joined by his daughter Virginie, works other parcels, including Les Vieux Clos, just below Coulée in the Savonnière AOC, and Le Clos de la Bergerie, tucked in the appellation of La Roche-Aumoin. Joly returned there in 1977 and found that the vines had fallen into disgrace. He soon came across a book by Rudolf Steiner, the Austrian philosopher. It was a copy of his 1921 lectures that became the basis for biodynamic farming. By 1984, Joly's entire vineyards had been converted to working biodynamically. At that point, he was well on his way to becoming a hero to some and a crackpot to others. I'm in the hero camp. I sat there that afternoon, mesmerized. My friend was right. I didn't have to say a thing as he channeled various mystical wisdoms. He was enthralling. His tasting roadshow, Renaissance des Appellations, or Return to Terroir, was bursting at the seams with new blood. He was thrilled. The new biodynamic enthusiast is like a young dog hunting on the first day, Jolie said. This new generation is fabulous. They were made for biodynamics. Today, the region is a hotbed of biodynamic viticulture, with people timing their treatments to the moon and wanting to taste wines on a fruit or flower day instead of a root or leaf. No matter what you believe, the wines farmed in this way are among the finest. To quote Jolie on the value of the scientific minutiae, look, as a farmer, you need water. How does it help you to know that water is H2O? Who to drink? Vinoble de la Coulée de Serran, biodynamic. Loïc Mailly, organic. Éric Morgat, organic. Domaine de Clausel, Eveline de Jessy, biodynamic. Domaine Aumoine, Tessa Laroche, biodynamic. Clément Barot, biodynamic. Thibaut Boudignon, organic. Damien Leroux, biodynamic. Patrick Baudouin, organic. Agnes and René Moss, biodynamic. Python Paille, organic. The Languedoc-Roussillon. The large area of Languedoc-Roussillon stretches from the western border of the Rhône to the Spanish border of Catalonia. It's circled by the Massif Central and the Pyrenees Mountains and embraced on its southern coast by the Mediterranean Sea. Even though it's blessed with limestone, such as parts of the well-known regions of Pic Saint-Loup, Saint-Jean-de-Menevoir, and especially in Corbière, and whatever other soils the globe can dream up, on the craggy vistas and wind-battered hills, it is the metamorphic that is the foundation for much of this area's identity. Ever since the Romans, this secret's been out that if you find flat, boring lands, it's almost too easy to grow grapes there. Thus began a regrettable reputation that has been difficult to overcome. Plonky brands like Fat Bastard became Languedoc-Roussillon's calling card. In the 90s, this brand became one of the leaders in the fighting varietals movement. Their bottles boldly put Pinot Noir or Syrah on the label instead of the place. This was heartbreaking, because in that land existed villages of such talent. Inside the Languedoc, up in the hills and cliffs, were appellations like Fougère and Saint-Chinian. In the Roussillon, there was Maury, Fitou, Collieu, and Bagnoul. They had an abundance of old vines, whipped into miniature bushes they called gobelets by the punishing winds and the infertile schistous soils, but which gave balanced wines of character. Tragically, they went begging because of the ensuing lack of respect. To super simplify their schist story, it's not dissimilar from the Anjou Noirs, just more recent. Sediment from Paleozoic era mud, clay, quartz, and fossils changed to schist, and some moved on to gneiss. Because of the development of the Pyrenees, the best soils also have altitude and proximity to the sea. The result is a profound amount of very complex soils with a dominance of schists that is more or less decomposed gneiss, and even in some patches, sedimentary-derived limestone-based soils. Fougère and Saint-Chinian are on the foothills on the Black Mountains, Montagne Noire, between 600 and 1,500 feet. Bagnoul and Coulier seem to plunge directly from the Elberez and Pyrenees Mountains to the Mediterranean Sea. Maury is at 1,200 feet. These altitudes are excellent for giving the vine what it needs, especially in hot areas. Cooler nights in order to retain freshness. Schists are particularly great when they sit at a right angle to the earth. That way the roots can go deep down and find water, alleviating what the vine pros called hydric stress when the plant shuts down because it is too hot and warm, which can lead to green, unripe tannins and aromas. And if they also have a little clay mixed with the limestone marl, even better. Given the heat-retaining power of schist, this is essential for important regions, as the slow ripening without cooking goes on through the dark hours. Fougère. Fougère, as an accepted wine-growing region, came into its own rather late, around the time of the French Revolution. Nearly two centuries later, it was given its appellation status in 1982. Yet its terroir of significant schist is so very noteworthy. It shows up in three forms. The large slabs are called dala. Hardly anything grows on that soil except the vine, and the yields are super low. Another less mean kind of soil is schist grisseux because of its more clay-like texture. The friable, very brittle, fragile type which you can break in your fingers is called frit. With constant erosion from the wind and the sun, the rock breaks down in the most lovely ways, making it easy to feed the vine the necessary nutrients. Many people here have a special relationship to their soil, such as Corinne Andrieux from Clos-Fantine. I think that schist radiates an energy that has an effect on the behavior of man, she wrote to us. Talk to different growers, and you'll get different ideas, but Pascaline and I are giving our votes to Grenache and Carignan. Carignan needs long, slow growth to be gorgeous. The Grenache needs to struggle so it doesn't create vines of such high alcohol you'll need an ice cube to drink it. But when all of these conditions are working together, the results can be spectacular. This area is spectacular for value. Who to drink? Clos-Fantine, Fougère, organic. Frédéric Bruca, Fougère, organic. Léon Barral, Fougère, biodynamic. Madalaison, Fougère, organic. Domaine Jean-Michel Alquier, Fougère, sustainable. Domaine Borde, Saint-Chinian, organic. Yannick Pelletier, Saint-Chinian, organic. Domaine Canet-Valette, Saint-Chinian, organic. Bagnoul and Collioure. It would be a pity not to mention the southwestern lands of Collioure and Bagnoul. Small and little known, they're more famous for their picture postcard harbors and delicious anchovies. They're also marked by thousands of schist terraces sculpting the black cliffs that seem to fall right into the sapphire blue of the Mediterranean. This is the beauty of contrast, and you can taste it in their wines. Historically, under the name Bagnoul, they were fortified, a technique developed during the 13th century where some alcohol is added during the fermentation of the grape in order to balance and preserve a wine. On the black, poor slopes, the hand-pruned Grenache, king of the Appellation in the three colors, yields little and concentrates intensely, getting just a little freshness from the sea. Only fortification and a long aging in demijohn glass or cask would tame such a beast of sugar, tannins, and alcohol to reveal, after years, bottles that can compete with that other fortified schist hero, port. Recently, because of the lack of market love for these wines and the improvement of chilling techniques, more dry vintages are being made. Most still on the overripe and monotone side, but don't let this fool you. There are gems among the rough. Who to drink? Domaine La Tour Vieille, Collioure, sustainable. Domaine du Traginet, Jean-François Dieu, Collioure, biodynamic. L'Appétit Bénus, Bagnoul, organic. Hélène Castex, previously Le Casseau de Maillot, Bagnoul, biodynamic. Bruno Duchesne, Bagnoul, organic. Galicia's Slate Zone. If France's Anjou Noir had a twin region, it would be on the northwestern shores of Spain's Galicia. Both regions border the Atlantic and are capable of producing wines of such very pretty transparency, wines that are gulpable yet never cease to satisfy. Both the Loire and Ribera Sacra start with granite near the coast. And while there are still a lot of granitic outposts, as you inch inland, you encounter a lot of schist and slate. But where in the Loire the search for schist leads you to the relatively flat land of Anjou, a search for metamorphic rocks in this part of Spain leads you through twisty roads into the mountainous Galicia and the magic kingdom of Ribera Sacra. Ribera Sacra. Sacred River is the meaning of Ribera Sacra, and it refers to the point where the Miño and Sil rivers converge. It gets its name from early Christian times, when holy sites and monasteries proliferated on the nearby pilgrimage path of Camino de Santiago. It's profoundly wine country, with vineyards rising up dramatically over both rivers. Those of the Sil are steeper, rockier, and more inaccessible than the greener, gentler banks of the Miño. Getting there is quite the experience. Arrive by plane into Vigo, stop at the wine bar Bagos in Pontevedra, taste Albarino in Rías Baixas, then drive inland past Orense. That's when the drive gets complicated with twisty hairpin turns up the mountains. Car sickness invariably results. Finally, the doors slam and out into the air there's relief. Scramble up to the stone-walled terraced vineyards and then stand in awe. Follow that prescription and I promise the full effect of this area's beauty will stun you. Ribeira Sacra might be one of the top places for breathtaking vineyards in the world. Because of the steep incline of the vineyards that dive down treacherously to the river, more than one person stumbles to their death during the harvest every year. The land is not only beautiful, but talented. So it is shocking that it only was granted DO status in 1996. We were in the region of Amandi with winemaker Roberto Santana. Originally from the Canary Islands, he and three other friends from Enology School created their collective winery called Envinate. The friends banded together to explore winemaking where the Atlantic Ocean has influence. They want to make, as they call them, vinos atlánticos. They found people who were working organically, or at least open to organic growing, where there were old vines and a history. For their Ribera experiment, they found three plots of earth, including a spot in slate-heavy dirt, punctuated by the pink quartzes and granite of Amandi. The draw was the temperate climate, with less rain than on the coast, and the potential for ripening red grapes was terrific. Santana popped open a bottle from that very vineyard, the Parcela Sewane. 100% whole grape cluster fermentation deepens the savory elements. As we sipped it, we found it rich for sure, fleshy, but with a rusty kind of core that some call minerality. Happily, in silence, I contemplated the plunging neckline of the slope, which dissolved into the Sil River below. "You have to be crazy to work here," I said to myself as I looked at Santana, thinking of the kind of glorious passion he and others have to rebuild the broken wall terraces, revitalize the soil, and either live here or commute to this rural, isolated, if beautiful, part of the world. Across the other bank and the mountain that rose off of it, through the early spring trees we could see the ghosts of the past, terraces from centuries past that had been abandoned long ago. I thought of all the tales of these forests being populated by witches, fairies, and ghosts, and at that moment I could almost see them for myself. So fogged over, even though the weather was not at all foggy, it was as if the image was shrouded in Vaseline.